The disclosures of torture by the U.S. military and the CIA at Guantanamo Bay and Abu Ghraib prison shocked many. After all, isn't torture the favorite weapon of dictators and repressive regimes? Darius Rajali, a professor of political science at Reed College, says that's not so. He says that the real innovators and exporters of 20th century torture have been democratic nations like the United States, France, and Britain. It's the subject of his latest book, Torture and Democracy, published by Princeton University Press. And it is with great pleasure that I welcome Professor Rajali to the show today. Hello.
Thank you, Leonard. Good to be here.
What got you thinking about connections between democracy and torture?
Well, I was out trying to map torture techniques, which is not something that a lot of people do.
And this is your second book on torture, so you've been thinking a lot about it.
That's true. I've been doing this for 30 years almost, and most of the original work on torture was primarily on victims and violators. Who are the torturers and what happened to the victims? But there wasn't a lot that was really scholarly about torture techniques, so I ended up kind of mapping techniques. I decided to map techniques over 200 years across the world. And it's not fun stuff. You know, you're trying to map Gestapo torture technique by year and place and stuff. And what you find is that there are clean techniques and scarring techniques. And as time goes by, scarring techniques decrease, clean techniques go up. And then you think, where are these coming from? And the answer turns out to be democratic states. And it's really interesting. You wouldn't think initially that democratic states would be innovators, just as you said, right? The democracies are run by the people. The people don't like to be tortured, so there won't be any torture. But in fact, what we find is that historically democracies have always had a place in torture. Greeks and Romans tortured. The Italian city-states all had inquisitional torture, even when they were democracies. The French, the Americans, the British were all torturing before World War II in their colonies. This was long before the CIA existed. So what we find is that many of these clean techniques are techniques that don't leave marks. They've existed for a long time, but they become much, much more common all of a sudden in the 60s, particularly after the 60s. And I became interested in why. And the short answer is, basically, the more people watch, the more there are journalists and newspaper reporters, the more there are human rights people, the less likely it is that people will use scarring techniques. Basically, interrogators get sneaky when we watch.
Do repressive regimes not worry about this? Are they less likely to use clean techniques?
For the early 20th century, that was right, because basically the only time they really wanted to use clean techniques was if they needed to make a good publicity relationship with the West. For example, the Nazis were clean when they were torturing Swedes. They wanted to make sure that the Swedes weren't too upset, but generally they weren't. What happens in the after the 1960s is we have developed a very good human rights monitoring regime where we audit torture worldwide. And as we monitored, authoritarian states realized that there was a percentage in cleanliness because legitimacy and was tied to bad publicity and you wanted to get your foreign aid, and it became very important to be clean afterwards.
What are examples of clean techniques? We're not talking about waterboarding here.
Well, only in the sort of margins. I think the most important technique in the 20th century is clearly electricity. Electro-torture used properly can leave no marks, but it's also an incredibly dangerous technique, and most authoritarian states are, why would we want to use this when we have whips? You know, I mean, there's no logic to it. There's just no percentage in doing that. And the only reason you'd want to do it is if you wanted to leave very few marks. So not surprising, the first
case... But it's effective, isn't it? It hurts a lot.
It certainly hurts a lot, but used badly, it can also kill your guy. And in torture, that's always a bad idea because what you want is the confession or the information. And electro-torture with high levels of amperage will knock you out every time and kill you. It also does other kind of nasty things. It's very labor-intensive. It makes your muscles really stiff and your bones break and jaws can't move. So it takes a while for these guys to want to use this. The only people who start using this are American police. 1908, we find the first case, the hummingbird, used in American prisons. 1915, Dallas, the electric monkey. Seattle had a whole cell called with an electric mat, which they used to coerce people out in the 20s. So a lot of this stuff happened, but the most important device was the field telephone magneto that was used by the French in 1931 in Vietnam. It's the thing that you've always seen on movies where you crank the thing and it makes a sound and you can talk to people, and cars had it too. this produces very low amperage, so it doesn't kill your man.
But it still hurts.
But it hurts a lot.
You were born and spent several years in Iran. Were the Savak using these techniques?
Yes. I mean, I grew up.
Is that how you got interested in this?
Well, yeah. I mean, one of the really interesting things about growing up in Iran is that in that time was you had a modern secular state, which was all about being Western, and torture wasn't considered to be incompatible with washing machines and cars and picking up the supermarket grocery and a little torture on the side. And you knew it was happening. Everybody knew it was happening, but nobody really wanted to deal with it. Even the Shah was like playing so the same kind of peekaboo politics that we see Dick Cheney playing, you know, like, well, I'm not going to say that we're not going to be tough on people. So this stuff existed. So for me, and that was the subject of my first book, torture and modern life, they went together. Torture wasn't this barbaric thing.
Aren't some of the torture techniques that are used today fairly ancient?
Some are.
Waterboarding is pretty old, isn't it?
Waterboarding is pretty old, but it's important to remember that most water torture that were used by ancient people were like things like boiling people alive, you know? I mean, these were things that left marks. Waterboarding is ancient. It was used primarily by priests of the Spanish Inquisition. Everyone knows this, but the reason they did this is because these priests, unlike other people, were a little squeamish about blood. They wanted the thing to be clean. And so they were it was a niche technique, which really didn't actually spread a lot until 1902, when we picked it up from the Philippines and we brought it back to the United States.
We also have a Navy training technique called the water cure, which is pretty much the same thing.
That's right. I think you should, in torture, you should never pay too much attention to what it's called. You should look at what people are doing. And there are really only two ways to do water torture.
Well, we had that situation where the nomination hearing of Attorney General Michael Mukasey, he refused to say whether waterboarding, for example, I think waterboarding was the one he was confronted with, was torture. It's pretty clear that it is. Why did we even go through that kind of exercise?
Well, whenever torture happens in a democracy, you always go through a kind of ritualistic dance. First you say, it never happened. Oh, it happened. It was a couple of bad apples. Well, now we're investigating. It's not as bad as everything. No, we're not going to call it torture. Then we're going to do an investigation. So I think we have to play this runaround game, because basically the truth is that the more specific you are about what the torture technique is, the more public sentiment goes against it.
My guest is Darius Rajali, who's written a book called Torture and Democracy. It's published by the Princeton University Press. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. Now, I guess the thing that confuses people most is why good people would use torture. The argument that was brought up, I guess, by Alan Dershowitz some years ago was that there can be situations where you have no choice. And 9/11 sure made a lot of people think about torture as one of the options.
Mm. Yeah, I mean, it's true. Actually, that argument is a very old argument. Alan Dershowitz brought it up, but it was actually invented by a French novelist during the Battle of Algiers.
The ticking bomb.
The ticking time bomb story comes from a novel, actually. It never really happened. But you have to understand, during the Battle of Algiers, people were arguing, the racist French were arguing that you should just whack the Arabs and they would need it. But you needed a different kind of argument to persuade liberals and socialists. And so the ticking time bomb argument was used to persuade them. And the truth is that this was one of the things the ticking time bomb example does is it hides the reality of torture. Torture is a wholesale business. It's not a retail business. You're going to have to torture thousands of innocents to get your one accurate hit. And that's what makes it a terrible business.
Well, in the film, The Battle of Algiers, the torture works. They do wind up finding the hiding place.
Yeah, and again, you know, I think people really need to get over sort of watching movies to get their information on torture and just get down with the reality. And, you know, let me tell you something. In the Battle of Algiers, according to the police, they issued 24,000 quote-unquote arrest warrants that were effectively torture warrants. Anybody, and that's excluding the military prisons, they were trying to get a about 1,400 people, about 700 of whom they killed or eliminated or actually turned to their side. Very few of the big breaks in the Battle of Algiers happened because of torture. Most of the big breaks happened because there were informers. Do you see any informers in the movie The Battle of Algiers? No. Now, there's a reason. That's a Marxist nationalist movie. And the whole point is that the FLN could never come to grips with the idea that they were betrayed by the very population they basically screwed over. And so the movie's got to say, well, if we lost the Battle of Algiers and the population had to be behind us, I mean, remember the last line of the movie is, we are the FLN, Algeria is the FLN, then it had to be that torture worked. And of course, that's convenient for the French, because the French also want to believe that torture worked. But basically, in Algiers, it was all done by standard policing. Colonel Godard got most of the key information through informers and people who penetrated the FLN.
Now, you said we shouldn't believe movies. What about TV shows like 24?
Identical stuff. Boy, you know, I don't watch the television and movie stuff anymore because I just find it, I mean, I just don't think people really even know how torture works. Having talked to torturers, know how torture works and so forth, I watch these guys and I think, you know, get a life. The bottom line with that is that the movies are dangerous in a different way. You have soldiers not just copying like techniques that supposedly work in the movies, like 24, but you have like those guys out at Mosul who were like copying Star Trek techniques, right? It kind of tells you this famous Colonel, you know, Captain Picard tortured by the Romulans with bright lights and so forth. I mean, one of the things that I am very interested in torture is how it works. I'm not really interested in why, and the more I get into how, the more I really think the ridiculousness of why.
Do you think that things like 24 have helped to desensitize the public and given the wrong impression as to what even constitutes torture?
Well, I think a lot of people worry about how apathetic culture has made us, but I'll tell you something. I've been looking at the polls, the real scientific polls, since 9/11, and the numbers haven't changed at all. No matter how many ticking time bomb stories have been told, 3/5 of the American public have been constantly against torture repeatedly. And no, they're not lying. I know people think this, but there are ways that we can sample this stuff and we know what the problems are. So it's never changed.
Well, there's also the Oscar that was given to Alex Gibney this year for a documentary that exposed the use of torture by the United States and its allies, which might suggest that there's also a bit of a backlash.
Oh, yeah. No, I mean, I'm pretty sure the backlash is going to come. I mean, the reality is that, you know, the more while public apathy is a concern, most of the evidence suggests that a lot of Americans, both Democrats and Republicans, stand firmly against torture. And it's strongest in the World War II generation, actually in the Korean War generation. And the younger you are, the more complicated it gets.
Because the World War II generation understood that that if you do it to them, they're going to do it to you.
That, and also they understood that what they fought for, they were in wars where it was very clear. You know, as the World War II poster said, torture is the method of the enemy. We fight to build a free world.
What role does the free press and monitoring by human rights groups have on the use of torture?
I think, you know, it has two effects. On the one hand, by shaming and blaming and putting things out there, it forces governments to change. Sometimes governments get really embarrassed by it, realize that this isn't a very practical approach, and stop torturing. This happens not just in democracies, but in authoritarian states like Soviet states, like Czechoslovakia or Hungary under the Soviet Union. Sometimes it has the perverse effect of the other side, which is that states become sneakier and they become much cleaner in the way that they torture. But let me just explain something. There are two kinds of monitoring. There's external monitoring and there's internal monitoring. You can really stop most torture in your system if you've got clear leadership, good punishment, protection for whistleblowers, and regular medical inspections. I mean, that will pretty much take care of the system. And if you've got police chiefs who are really committed to that, they can clean up the system really fast. The problem is that when you're on the outside, like a human rights monitoring group, you have to be invited into the inside. And I think third world countries who want to clean up their act, who have invited Human Rights Watch or the Council of Europe or whatever to come in and do it, have no problems with this stuff. So monitoring has different effects depending on the quality.
And if you're sophisticated about it, you can just keep on torturing and nobody will be able to figure out what you're doing.
Well, a really good reason why I wrote my book is we need some more political literacy here. We all know stuff that happened 50 or 60 years ago. We think of torture, of the memories we had and the people that have told us these stories from childhood and barracks and schools and stuff like that. Let's be clear, the face of torture has changed.
It has changed for the, you said, to be more clean.
It's much clean. So we all now need to learn a new language of pain.
There was an article in the Sunday Times in which a man said, you know, we spend billions of dollars to develop spy satellites, and we get very little information from them. We now, on the other hand, interrogation techniques can give us an awful lot of valuable information, and we pretty much don't know much about what succeeds and what fails.
I think that's true.
He said we need more research.
We absolutely. And there's a wonderful report out by National Defense University, major experts going through this. And, you know, we know what doesn't work, but we actually do need much more serious work on how you get true quality interrogation done effectively. We know that for cooperative witnesses, we've got a technique called the cognitive interview, which works very well. But for hostile witnesses, we need to figure out another process. And the best process we have is the technique developed by the Gestapo, actually called the Scharf method, the Luftwaffe method, which actually works very nicely. You build a rapport, and then you try and get info.
In fact, there is a U.S. Army field manual titled Human Intelligence Collector Operations that argues against coercive methods and says that people under stress respond best to kindness and understanding. Well, since the Gestapo knew that and the U.S. Army knew that, then why are we doing these other things?
Well, I think there's a lot of fear and there's a lot of sense of helplessness after 9/11. I think that's that certainly happened. Secondly, it's really important to realize we have myths coming out of World War II and the Battle of Algiers that constantly tell us torture works. Movies tell us torture works. And what people really don't know is the thing that really works is public cooperation. That if you don't have the public willing to come to you and talk to you, the chances that you'll solve a crime in these large studies falls to 10%. So you really need to have the public on your side. And if you keep on torturing, no one's going to walk in your door.
My guest is Darius Rejali. His book, Torture and Democracy, is published by Princeton University Press. We will continue our conversation after we take a little break. Stay with us. We're back with Darius Rejali, his second book on torture, this time not just focused on Iran and the impact of torture there. It's called Torture and Democracy. It's published by the Princeton University Press. Well, the president vetoed a bill that would have restricted torture techniques, and it's interesting that John McCain, who has been a very strong critic of anything that would allow for more torture, has turned around on this. So there must be a political component to whether people are for or against torture.
Yeah, I think so. I think a significant portion of this is when we look at, well, first of all, when we look at people who support torture, the 35% to 45% who regularly vote for torture, a large portion of this is loyalty, is basically the, when we look at what predicts their support, what most predicts it is not whether a Democrat or Republican, but whether they want to be loyal to the troops and loyal to the president. And a lot of this is driven out of loyalty.
Well, the Bush administration says that techniques, well, it says it's not using waterboarding anymore, but techniques like waterboarding have helped obtain valuable information and are essential to preventing terrorism.
Yeah. Well, I look forward to the data on that one. I mean, I'm a social scientist, so I'm not going to work with imaginary numbers.
Well, they tell you they can't tell you.
Exactly. And what I can say is that every time we as historians have had a chance to go back and look at the data from other cases, whether it's the Project Phoenix or Battle of Algiers, we find that that's not the case.
Were the Geneva Conventions already in place during the Battle of Algiers?
The Battle of Algiers the Geneva Conventions didn't apply because it was considered to be an internal fight within France. And so it took the Red Cross forever to persuade the French to even go into the prisons.
So isn't a similar argument used with Guantanamo?
Almost identical arguments, in fact. These are all arguments that have been recycled by the French. These are standard French colonial arguments that have found a new life in America.
So, but that would be different than Abu Ghraib. Abu Ghraib is something that was punishable, and we punished a couple of people.
Yeah, I mean, I think the problem with Abu Ghraib and a lot of these other sort of circumstances is that the torture problem is a wide, diffuse, and complex problem. And if we just focus on waterboarding, we just focus on, you know, should the CIA do it, but the Army not, we forget some of the bigger problems. There's a lot of torture talk. I just study torture. And here's the reality. The reality is that once you have paralleled systems where you let one person torture, say the CIA, and the other person not torture, say the Army, what happens is there's torture creep. Eventually, the guy on the other side says, why should I be stuck doing B-type methods when those guys can use A-type methods? And all these methods are clean, so you're never going to track it. So right now, frankly, we're just waiting for our next torture crisis.
Well, you have to wonder what goes on in the minds of good people who engage in that torture creep.
Well, I think it really depends. We've talked to torturers. We know how hard and what a terrible price they pay.
Because some of them seem like really nice people. They, you know, if you were writing that newspaper article, he was such a nice boy.
Virtually all of them are really nice people. I think we need to remember that most torturers are ordinary people, and that organizations that torture hire their torturers for loyalty, patriotism, and not because they're masochists and sadists.
What about the other way of farming out the torture? Often we read about people who were sent to places, to other countries that are known to employ really terrible forms of torture.
Yeah, no, I think rendition, which is what you're describing, actually breaks two of the most important cardinal rules of intelligence. One is you never surrender your assets to foreign intelligence people. I mean, it's kind of amazing that we actually think the Syrians are actually going to give us true information about the people they're interrogating. It boggles the mind, right? But on top of that, you never, ever, no matter, even if you gave it to a friend, never give information and depend on it without double-checking it or having other ways to double-check it. And we say we can't do it because we don't speak Arabic, we don't have the culture and so forth, which means basically we can't check it. So we end up relying on foreign powers who really don't necessarily have our best interests in mind. And to me, rendition just compounds the problems of bad intelligence that torture gets you.
What role, if any, can the Congress, for example, play in stopping the use of torture if the president, in this case anyway, uses his right to veto as he did this weekend?
Yeah, well, I think, I mean, one of the things I repeatedly find in my research is that it's extremely hard to legally regulate torture. I mean, torture has not one slippery slope, but several slippery slopes, and it's incredibly corrosive. So just legally banning it, there are many times that people have tried to do that. That doesn't work. What you really have to do is you have to protect the whistleblowers. You have to protect people. You know, I mean, we're not going to either catch fraud or anything else if we don't protect whistleblowers who identify for us when we're getting bad intelligence, when rules are being broken. And that's really where we need to put the work. We also need to, I think Congress needs to think more clearly about exactly what we want to do with Guantanamo. And that's a very serious issue in time.
Well, no matter who becomes the next president, I suspect that the policies toward torture will change. But I also suspect that we won't really deal with it. We won't have a truth and reconciliation commission of the sort that we've seen in South Africa to deal with whether we have done something awful.
I think that's right. Well, I mean, there are values both. I mean, I know a lot of people want truth and reconciliation committees. Others, people want trials. And there are negatives to both of them. I mean, you can try people, but the problem is that you only kind of get the lower ones who were forced to do the work, not the suits who actually, the middle tier officers and so forth, who go on to have their fine careers, right? And that's been a problem in Argentina, and the truth commissions aren't going to work either. I think the most important problem that we have to watch out for, I'll be clear about this, is that after both of the wars in which we have used torture and both of the wars that the French have used torture, those soldiers who have tortured and have come back, and what jobs did they get? policemen and private security. And what inevitably happens is that those torture techniques start appearing domestically. Look, there's no sharp line between international and domestic torture. This stuff travels. And so the stuff starts appearing in your neighborhood. The waterboarding that we all talk about today was something that just happened in the Philippines, but it was brought back by American troops and appeared in police stations all through the American South by the 20s. So in the next 20 years, good luck. You should buy my book just because you're going to need it in your neighborhood.
The president said that one of the problems with limiting interrogation techniques is that the terrorists in this case will then know what techniques we're going to use and that they will prepare themselves to deal with it.
Well, frankly, if that's what the president thinks, then he should actually have signed that bill on waterboarding, because the terrorists all now know that we knew waterboard, and so they'll train for it. If he really believes that, he should have
vetoed
that.
Well, how can you train for waterboarding? Waterboarding, what, they hold you back.
Yeah, I know. Exactly.
They pour water down, they blindfold you and pour water up your nose?
They can do that. Yeah, that's one of the techniques. That's called the Dutch technique, and it's a specific form of choking. But let me just be clear. My own view is that you can't train for torture, and it's based on all the psychological studies and a lot of other stuff, which basically shows that, you know, whether or not you survive torture or whether you can resist torture entirely depends on your past history and the kind of experiences you had, not whether you train for it. You know, when you look at the Al-Qaeda manuals, when you look at the IRA Green Book, when you look at the Soviet dissident stuff and the Iranian guerrilla stuff, they all tried to train their guys when they go into torture. They knew exactly what tortures they were facing. They all tried to say, you know, buck up. And the most you find in these books is, you know, just be brave. And that's the reality of it. The reality is that no one can predict how you're going to behave once you're in that system.
Well, if everybody knows that torture is not the most effective way, then really we have to deal with it as something else, which is I'm more powerful than you are.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, look, everyone says, oh, my God, all these states use torture. It must mean that it works for information. Well, it's almost, you know, that's not the case. Torture can be used for many other purposes besides information. It can be used for false confessions, which can be just as good as true confessions if you want to convict people. And often that's what happens. Stalin, of course, demonstrated that to us marvelously. And it can also be used, and especially is used, for intimidation. Basically to say, who's boss? And most importantly and most insidiously, torture can be used to recruit informers. You can blackmail people and say, look, sign this false confession saying that you murdered someone, and then blackmail them to be your informer and stooge.
But doesn't it also work the other way? Wouldn't torture play a role in helping terrorist organizations to recruit people to their cause?
Yeah, I mean, I grew up in Iran, and I remember the Shah saying, you know, you guys are just medieval obscurantist, fundamentalist Islamic radicals, and Khomeini saying, yeah, look who's talking, the guy who tortures. And nothing recruited stuff to Khomeini's side. Most people then torture. Most people forget the Iranian Revolution was all about torture. It was all about America has trained the Shah to torture, and people flocked to Khomeini because they wanted human rights, not because he was some religious guy. But then by the time they were done with it was too late.
We've also been accused of teaching people in South America to torture.
Yeah, I mean, I think there is
Latin America.
There is certainly an argument to be made for example, how we've trained people in Brazil in particular with the use of torture, and I think that's true. But I think the important thing to remember is that clean torture techniques aren't just distributed by America. They appear in all sorts of places where we don't have military or other sorts of connections. Even authoritarian states use these clean techniques too. So although that accounts for some small portion, actually, of the techniques, most torture around the world these days is very low tech, and there's a reason for that. Because when you have someone running through your police station, you don't want a big sensory deprivation sitting there in the basement. I mean, that's silly. What you want is a broomstick, a rubber tube, and a bucket of water so no one can stop you.
Or a pair of pliers.
Or a pair of pliers. Something that no one can spot, no one can object to, right? So a lot of torture remains low tech. I mean, we can come up with theories about how America did this and that, but really, that accounts for like less than 1% probably of all the things that are out there.
My guest is Darius Rejali, professor of political science at Reed College. His latest book, Torture and Democracy, is published by Princeton University Press. Well, one of the places torture is being addressed is in the courts. Now, what has been the role of the judicial system in deciding the appropriateness of torture historically?
You mean in the United States?
I would think. I'm not so sure I care whether the French have decided somewhere down the line that they shouldn't do it anymore.
Well, I mean,
but I do care as an American what's going on in this country.
I think that that's fair enough. Well, I think the issue of torture in the courts, to the extent that it's come up, has been pretty clear. For example, there's a series of judicial decisions that go back to 1902, both in military and civilian courts, that describe water tortures, including waterboarding, as torture and condemnable and punishable, frankly. Likewise, sleep deprivation was singled out by Ashcroft v. Tennessee in the Supreme Court. So we know that where the American courts stand on the question of torture.
But does it really matter? Is it easy to prosecute government agencies or government officials accused of engaging in these activities?
Generally not. And the reason is for a lot of reasons, one of which, of course, is that they are generally protected by the positions that they hold. However, there are a number of – I'm willing to bet that sooner or later there will be some bright lawyers that will figure out how to use the Torture Victims Protection Act or other civil liability things to actually make, say, private contractors pay. I mean, you know, a lot of us are focusing on, like, government officials, but there are a lot of private contractors who do interrogation. And if they've been involved in torture and this isn't part of their contract, I think they're probably civilly liable.
I've always wondered about some of the things that I read about, like blasting rock and roll. I remember when General Noriega they were trying to get him out of his lair, and they blasted rock and roll songs at him.
Yeah, well,
I mean, I know it would work with me, but at least some rock and roll song.
That's true. Well, you know, I mean, loud noise goes back a long way.
Oh, is it loud noise?
It's basically what it is. There's high-tech noise and there's low-tech noise. High-tech noise is white noise. And low-tech noise is like blasting loud amounts of things to hurt your eardrums.
Blasting an Alvin Lee guitar solo might very well have a real impact. Well, no more. He's playing the same notes again and again and again.
Right. Well, I mean, Mother Jones, I think, had a top 20 hit of all the music that's played on their site right now. You can get the Torture Top 20. It includes the Barney song, a few other things. You know, and again, I go back to the Mickey Mouse nature of all of this, right? We're not talking about white noise. White noise is something very specific, and you really need to have special machines to generate it. And, you know, the truth is that playing loud noise is like the American equivalent of taking bagpipes into battle. It's showy. It doesn't do anything.
In the movies, truth serums were used as well.
Yeah.
Well, do they work?
No, they don't. And, you know, don't take my word for it. Take the CIA's word for it. It studied close to 300 drugs to see if they could get truth out of people. And this huge, probably one of the largest, most secret interrogation programs ever sort of done. They tried every drug using dozens of universities and hidden projects, and they came to the conclusion you got nowhere. In fact, one of the things my book shows is that overall, worldwide, the use of drugs has been declining in torture, no matter how you use it. And again, that's because our capacity to identify drugs in your system mechanically through human rights monitoring has increased. Mm-hmm. No one is stupid enough to use drugs anymore.
LSD didn't work either.
LSD doesn't work. I mean, all of this stuff, you have to remember, the guy who invented truth serum wasn't even a scientist. He was an obstetrician from Texas. And his name was Dr. Robert House. And he didn't know anything about what he was talking about.
Now, it took you 12 years to write this book, and this is your second book on torture. What's the hardest part about staying focused on such a dark and disturbing subject?
You stop liking people. I mean, the bottom line is, if you put cruelty first in your life, you constantly wonder about how can people be so stupid. The more you kind of realize that the world really is basically fundamentally got some basic rules of how human beings behave, and they're very sound rules, and when you kind of depart from these, it's silly. And so you start developing a kind of misanthropy about people. And I do a lot of stuff just to try and like people again.
And you said that, interestingly, 9/11 did not convince people that we should use torture. What about Alan Dershowitz's book, which took a nuanced position on the subject?
Yeah, I mean, all I can tell you is there really hasn't been there were no torture polls before 9/11. All the polls started happening after 9/11. And what happened was that we keep on finding almost identical numbers, regardless of how hysterical people want to be, no matter how much they want to shout up and down. The numbers have not change. And regardless of that, whatever the polling is, even if the, I mean, let me just say that if the American majority was really for torture, we wouldn't have all this double talk.
Darius Rajali will be in conversation with Stacey Sullivan on Wednesday, March 12th, at this coming Wednesday at 6:30 at the NYU School of Law. He'll be speaking and signing books on Thursday at 5:30 at the Carnegie Council for Ethics and International Affairs. For more information, you can go to our show page at WNYC.org. His book, Torture and Democracy, is published by Princeton University Press. And I want to thank you so much for being with us today.
It was a great pleasure to be here, Leonard. Thank you.
On tomorrow's show, Albie Sachs, South African Constitutional Court Justice, talks about his life's work as a white South African activist, also the Latin language and its role as a central part of Western culture for more than 2,000 years. Then we'll hear about the ongoing restoration project at the Parthenon in Athens. Also, a look at the buildings in New York City that have been saved thanks to our landmarks law. The Leonard Lopate Show is produced by Blakeney Schick, Sarah English, and Scott Goldberg. Melissa Egan is the executive producer. We had help today from Angela Sheldon, Fran Jacobs, Leslie Dickstein, and Tanya Mirza. Jay Cowett was at the audio controls. I'm Leonard Lopate, your host. Thanks for listening. We'll see you tomorrow.